Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted,
the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Welcome to episode 125 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
So let's just start by saying this may very well be a long episode. Get a drink, maybe a snack, find a place you could be comfortable, sit down, at least sit down, if not lie down.
And no, don't lie down. You'll go to sleep.
Oh, that's right. Maybe not. Maybe recline, but not all the way. Like a Roman style, like on the side, on the
back. Unlike the meditation and hypnosis CDs, you can listen to this while you're driving.
That's true. I think it's pretty safe. And just before we go on, the last thing, did I say it might be long?
You said it.
Okay. So what are we actually going to talk about? Sorry.
Now we are going to do our read-along. And this week we are discussing chapter 36 entitled Preston Pans.
And we're in a new section as well.
God, this chapter should just be a section all by itself.
Oh my gosh.
Like I queued up my audiobook today and it was like...
And Davida screams at her.
It was like 70-something minutes, like over an hour. Like I was like, oh... If Davina's going to talk for an hour, Ginger's going to talk for at least three.
Oh my goodness. Stop with the insults, girlfriend. Oh, and this is also the beginning of a new section called Flames of Rebellion, which sounds awfully like a section or a chapter or something in a book, like two or seven books down the road, maybe two or three books down the road.
We're not there yet.
No, not quite. Oh, Lord have mercy. No, I can't even think. Okay, real quick. And I know it's already too long when I say that. Summer had done a good part of the initial organization or laying out this schedule or the chapter names and everything and the page numbers. And so I was updating the dates because we try to extrapolate or project approximately how many more weeks or, you know, when each chapter will be recorded, posted, whatever, at least in weeks, if not dates. Oh my gosh, girls. We hope there are gentlemen listening. We will. We guarantee we'll be done by the time premiere occurs, even though we don't have a date yet. So we're going to have to be open to combining stuff that may make for super long episodes. But all that having been said, thinking of future books makes my insides squeeze because I can't imagine, like, was it in Moby? There's like 190 something chapters. I can't even think that. I don't know how we're going to do it.
She can't even finish the sentence right now, people.
I don't know how we're going to do it.
I almost felt like she was having a stroke for a second.
Stop it with the stroke stuff.
It was like,
you know what I'm saying? It kind of, and I know we don't
do
have to
do you know what you're
right
saying?
Yes, I've already finished that sentence. Okay, that's a future problem for a future date. Or a future worry for a future date. But
yeah, Moby's like...
Oy, 10 years down the road?
No.
8 years?
Like 5.
Moby?
Moby's like book 8, right?
Yeah.
We're on 2.
Yeah. That's at least
so
6.
So 6. And that's if they don't split seasons. So we'll just at least we'll say 6.
It's not that I hope they do, because then it'll take us till we're 100 to actually see the whole thing, if they do everything. But at some point, they might... I don't know. It's like part of you wants them to get stuff in, but... Oh my gosh. Okay, let's just go on. So,
oh my God, this
back
chapter
to
is
chapters
long
36. That's what I was saying. By the time I say just a quick aside, it's like, no, it's already too, it's already not quick.
You've never been one for quick,
to be quick.
Anything.
Mm.
We're talking as involved.
I'm a fast talker. I'm a fast walker. I do a lot of things quickly, but as far as like.
But you do them in a circular fashion, which means.
I don't walk in a circle.
No, you speak in a circular fashion.
Sometimes. What I'm trying to say is I do a lot of things quickly, but when it comes to getting to the point, that may not be one of them.
That was me getting to my point about you not getting to your point.
And let's go on.
Preston Pans.
We are in Scotland, September of 1745. Connie writes, we've taken a big time jump since the beginning of this book. DIA starts out in the winter of 1744 in Paris. Jamie and Claire left Paris in late summer 1744. They spend several months at Lallybroch over the winter and spring and into summer. This chapter begins September 1745, 4 days before the Battle of Prestonpans, which took place on the autumnal equinox, September 21st, 1745. Lisa T. writes, the chapter begins by Claire thinking, quote, the crisp weather of early fall made it seem much more like picnicking than a march to war, unquote. The mood is clearly upbeat. So the men of Lallybroch have followed their laird into battle. They're settled in at camp after marching for 4 days. It's early fall. War's coming, and soon, according to Claire's memory. Jamie asks her to tell him again for the dozenth time. And we read, she's riding Donis, so he's still around.
It seems like the worst, like, bedtime story. I know it's not bedtime when it happens, but it's like, you know when kids are like, tell me that story again, Mom, or Daddy, tell me that story again. She's like, tell me again, Claire. Tell me again how we're all about to die.
Unfortunately, Claire only knew what little she'd learned from her school books as a child. The battle was fought near the town of Preston, hence the Battle of Prestonpans. But the Scots call it the Battle of Gladsmere, according to an old prophecy about a returning king to be victorious at Gladsmere. Now, I had no idea of this, and I definitely didn't remember it from a previous read. So, apparently, Gladsmere was not important. Connie has provided a link that we'll share regarding Gladsmere in our show notes. The Scots win, and that's about all Claire can offer Jamie at this point. She feels bad she doesn't know more, but there's no helping it. He asks her to tell him once more. So this is twice he said, tell me once more.
Tell me again, Claire. Tell me how we die. But you also remember, like, her, the her book. The book
is that the title of this chapter? Of this chapter. Is the title of this episode, tell me again, Claire. Tell me how we die. Although I can't put an accent in the...
I don't know.
Tell me once more, Mama, how it die.
I don't know. But if you remember, the book she also remembers is a children's history book. Like, so as an adult.
So it's not going to be that bloody.
So as an adult, she never thought to pick up history books or was into that sort of a thing. So she's almost no help to Jamie at this juncture, other than to be just to kind of relay the story in large terms of, well, it was kind of in that one area. And I mean, you won. That's all you need to know. This one you won. But ultimately, it's just a downward march from there.
Tell me again how we die. We need to start doing outtakes because, like, in the beginning of our episodes. Oh my gosh.
Just
for 50 pages?
Do it.
There's something about cock hairs and lice.
Yes, there
and,
is.
And a ravishing.
I remember it.
And a teenage boy. And
a broken arm.
And an arm. And
an almost slit throat.
And a priest in a tartan, played, whatever. An almost slit throat.
Okay, get back to it.
See? Donut.
Donuts. I want a donut.
I want a donut, too. Damn carbs. Since, like, the 90s, our dad has called donuts fat pills. Remember that?
I've never heard him say that.
Oh, my gosh. Totally ask him. The Jacobites were outnumbered. This is Claire retelling. Again. Tell me more. What? Please, sir, may I have some more? That was really bad, like,
you
could bad
totally
English slash Southern. Oh my gosh. They surprised General Cope's army at dawn, charging out of the rising sun. Hundreds of casualties on the English side, only a few on the Jacobite side. 30, to be exact. That was the exact number of people from Lallybroch who'd come along. This is quite sobering. Connie writes, imagine if any American was thrust 200 years back in time and asked to tell a Canadian about the Battle of Grand Pré in Canada in 1747. Suppose you had even heard of it, but your interrogator wants all the details, the order of battle, what happened, when it happened, etc. Claire hadn't had a formal education, much less extensive education about the history of Scotland. The major Jacobite risings were called the Jacobite Rebellions by the ruling governments. The First Jacobite Rebellion and Second Jacobite Rebellion were known respectively as the 15 and the 45, after the years in which they occurred, 1715 and 1745. And Connie has shared an article with us from Wikipedia, which we will also include in our show notes. Ellen G. writes, did we know that Claire had some of what you might call a photographic memory? Well, that is how she kept giving Jamie information from her memories, recreating the memory of reading A Child's History of England in a Hut in Persia. Really, is that how she was educated? She did it herself. She was that inquisitive? Lisa I. writes, I can imagine as the Battle of Prestonpans was drawing closer, the weight was all on Claire's shoulders. In the next scenelet, the men are sitting around the campfire. Lots of scratching, lots of men had lots of lice. They were talking about the best way to get rid of lice. I love this scene. Apparently, it's really hard to get rid of them when they're in your cock hairs.
Whoa.
Jeez, I love Diana. Wallace Fraser says, watching his friend scratch himself, gives me the yuck. Now, this is a verb meaning to itch. I looked this up in Merriam-Webster's, and that's exactly what I thought it meant. Not just because it's lice, but because what does that remind you of? Yuck.
Isn't there a German word? Mm-hmm. Es juckt mich.
Mm-hmm. Jucken is the infinitive form of the verb to itch. So yes, it definitely has a link to German. So it makes sense with its linguistic influence. This would make it into Scots. So let's list the ways to get rid of lice in this area. Lift your kilt, smoke them out. Shave off half the hairs, set the other half on fire, then spear them with the dirk as they run from one side to the other.
I mean, ow.
The second best way...
They're so tiny.
...is to pour whiskey on them, get them drunk, and drop them off.
Drop them off?
And they will drop
off. Where are you
going
to drop them? Is there like a lice pool? Like you drop them off at the pool?
At the mall, the lice mall. But according to Jamie, the best way is to have your wife pick them off one by one.
You know what? That actually is the best way.
According to Claire.
Not even according to Claire. We had a lice outbreak, 2 years ago?
Oh, no.
Last year?
I guess so, yeah. Last fall.
And we've tried all of the other home remedies where you douse each other and spray you down and whatever. And we finally paid a lady after second outbreak at her school.
Listen, if you're interested in a side career or a full-time job, this woman... I'm not saying she's
like
rich,
a mobile but she lice remover.
She's never not busy.
Yeah.
She's paid well.
I don't know what we paid her, but
probably a few $100.
She did all of us. And she basically went through and with a very fine tooth comb and combed all of our hair.
And she had gloves on, right?
Oh yeah.
Oh thank God. Okay.
She went through all of our hair and looked for lice and picked nits and bugs and anything that was there was picked out. I did not have any on my head.
Me either.
Ginger didn't have any. And my daughter, who was the one that the whole thing was started from, because this was the second outbreak at her school, even she didn't find anything on her. What was really funny is the one person that they did find them on was Mom.
Which is so sad and so funny because she's the most clean freak we know.
Summer can't talk.
Did you mention Dad?
Well, he didn't have any.
Our dad doesn't really have any hair, so go Dad. So you bald guys out there, first of all, bald is sexy.
That's another way to get rid of them, apparently, is you shave your head. Get rid of all of the anything that they might want to live in. But yeah, no, the one person... The one person of all of us that we thought wouldn't have them.
And oh my gosh,
the one
because
who
she's
them.
Obsessed. In a nice way. In a positive way. Obsessed with cleanliness. Yet she had lice. It's not funny. Oh, it's not funny. But it's
But yeah, after that, funny. We didn't see any more issues. But, we did the home treatments before then where, you basically put that chemical shampoo in your hair and let it sit for a time. And then you rinse it out. And then you... have really gross looking hair for a few days. But we tried that and clearly that was not enough to have killed whatever was going on her head then. But yeah, she came through and basically picked them all off of where she could find them. I didn't have any and God, I just said lice and now I'm itching.
It's suggestive, girl.
It is totally suggestive. Anyway, but yeah, picking them out one by one is actually the best way to do it. So I concur with Claire.
Claire straight up took care of Jamie because if she didn't, he'd have them.
And then she'd have them.
And so she's going through his hair. And he's enjoying her going through his hair. And he expressed his pleasure at this. And Summer, are you someone who would agree that, or for you, there's almost nothing more pleasurable than having someone brush your hair? Or massage your scalp, whichever. Basically, it has to do with your head.
No, my favorite thing is getting my hair shampooed at the hairstylist.
That's a head massage.
Yeah, I know.
That's what I'm saying.
That's my favorite.
Well, it's like... the easiest,
you know, it's so funny.
Because you're not paying extra for it. I'm just like, oh my God, I hope she takes a really long time.
I know, but here's
Doesn't
the
that
thing.
Sound really gross?
She, I know, but here's, I've had this conversation with
Only
her.
Only time I'm happy a woman to rub me.
What?
My head.
You need to work on that.
No.
Your delivery on
Shampoo
that was a little
my
bad.
My head, I know.
But I've talked to her about it because she does a really good shampoo, let me tell you. But she's had clients where she's had to tell them that if they didn't stop moaning, she was going to stop shampooing
their
hair.
The current person we both have, Shut up. I'm going to have to ask her. We won't mention her name. I love this woman.
I dare you to just start like moaning the next time she shampoos your hair.
I'm going to her like in 2 weeks.
Me too. Well, I'm on the 30th.
You can't.
No, I won't.
It'd be so funny if we showed up the same day.
No, I'm on the 30th. But yeah, no,
well,
you
hold
totally.
Hold on. Now I got to break out my date. Hold on. Because if you're going to share, I have to share. Hold on. Oh, I had that. Yes, I have the 23rd. So yeah,
you totally need, please moan in the chair, please.
I don't
and then
think
tell
I can.
Me all about it.
I can't. Wait, so how did it happen? You were getting your hair, head,
we
hair.
Were just, we
she
were
was
just,
doing your hair and you were talking about how good it feels or no?
I was not in specifics to
that
her.
That sounds really bad.
I was
no.
Like, you're so good at that.
No.
No, I always, I
you
think
said,
I made a comment.
I like this part.
I said, this is like my favorite part. I said, because you know, I can't do this for myself because,
like,
you know.
Send me home with a wet like, head just the next hour. Well, I'm paying just, you.
No,
I'll pay you just to
that.
Do my
it's
head.
Just, you know, when I try, I can't, it's not the same when you wash your own hair.
Of course not. It's like you
somebody
can't
else,
yourself.
You can't do the right, that same pressure. So I'm like, and she said she had one of her clients who said, you know, she'd pay her to come and wash her hair in her shower. And she was like, okay, would your husband
and that's
mind?
A little awkward. Just come here. I'll come here once a week and I'll pay
so,
you.
And then I asked her, I was like, do you ever have any like people who like get really into it? And she's like, I've had some moaners. I've had to ask them to stop.
Oh.
Anyway. Yeah. I love getting my hair shampooed.
So as she's going through his hair, she teases him that she may use Myrta's method of the torch. And he says, you try that and I'll do the same to you. She reminds him of Louise de la Tour about what she said about bald lassies. And that's all we're going to say about that. Lisa T. writes, in this scene, we see the men. Oh my God.
What? Now you're totally itching.
I can't handle this too much. Like everywhere. Oh, this is awful. Oh my God. I have to tweet that. Hold on.
I hate you.
Don't hate me. Oh
I hate Diana in this chapter.
I know. It's like, oh my God. Oh, this is awful. Lisa T. writes, in this scene, we see the men, quote, lazily enjoying the feeling of full stomachs, exchanging stories and scratching, unquote. Again, the mood is fairly lighthearted, and they are all well-fed and scratching themselves because of lice. It's interesting that Jamie is looking at his men like children and not soldiers. Again, the mood is not at all that of an army on the march. Jamie's stomach growls. He hadn't eaten yet.
Did you eat?
Oh my God, plenty.
You like have a little dinosaur that lives in your throat. A little tiny one.
Jamie's stomach growls. He hadn't eaten yet. So Claire goes to look for food in the saddlebags. And we get the backstory of the tent. Myrta had had the forethought of putting her, Claire, in the tent with Jamie. So in case they oomph, the men wouldn't have to see something that they couldn't have. So, I mean, obviously it is for her benefit too, but he's actually thinking of the men, which is important because they're the ones who are potentially about to lose their lice. I love Myrta.
Lice. Did you say lice?
We hope they lose their lice, but not their lives. I love Myrta. Claire lectures Jamie on good health and vitamin C. They both have good teeth. At one point he says, I'll admit you're very well preserved, Sassenach, for such an old crone.
Because of the teeth. Because yeah. Neither of them have scurvy.
And this is more information that she's sharing with him. This information can save a lot of people. Vitamin C not only saves your teeth, it can save lives. She's front-loading him with information that will potentially help many people. In Outlander, she tells them of planting potatoes, right?
Yes.
And now she's talking a lot about greens and all the different places vitamin C lurks or...
Lurks.
Where it lurks.
Because it's evil. It's an evil lurking vitamin.
Where it exists. Oh my gosh. Suddenly there's a scuttle and Jamie is pulled backward off the log they're sitting on. It's a moonless night, so she couldn't see anything, but she could hear scuffling in the dried leaves. Grunts, and she hears the noise of conflict and curses. There's a short, sharp cry and then silence. Jamie then returns from the blackness with a captive, one arm twisted behind his back. He shoved the man against a tree. The other men were thus roused. The intruder is brought into the firelight, and the interrogation begins. It was a male with a small, fine-boned face, big, long-lashed eyes, 16 years old, English, a Hampshire accent, Claire tells us. Jamie says age doesn't matter. This little dude had just tried slitting his throat.
He did not say dude.
No, that's my words.
Yeah.
Jamie says the age part doesn't matter is what I mean.
He doesn't. And you called him a man, and he was clearly not a man. He was a boy.
Well, until they saw his face, they didn't know that. Lisa T. writes, this moment is very pivotal for several reasons. One, which cannot be named at this time.
Voldemort. Can it be named?
Yes. This attempt at Jamie's life shatters the jovial, picnic-like atmosphere and is the beginning of the end of the relative peace that has surrounded Jamie and Claire. They start to realize their fragility and vulnerability.
Can we just say anything that's spoilery? Can we just call it Voldemort from now on?
No, I don't want to get in any kind of
turf war. I mean, what?
Oh,
is
no,
it going to be a turf war?
Turf war.
I'm just saying, if you're going to, instead of saying spoiler, we don't want to talk about that because it's spoiler. We can't talk about that right now, but just say it's Voldemort.
Immediately, the boy says he'll not share any intelligence. His arm was evidently injured. He was trying very hard not to express any pain. While Jamie describes the setting of the attack, his assessment of the captives, being alone, etc., three men go into the dark to investigate. Now, this is Jamie's attack of what happened to him by the boy. He's trying to say what happened.
His attack of what happened to him?
The attack on him by the boy. The boy says that he'd attacked Jamie in order to release Claire from his custody. He says he recognized his face, Jamie's face, from the broadsheets in Hampshire and Sussex. So this is to remind us, Jamie's a wanted man again.
Still.
Again.
He's always been wanted.
Oh, Summer. Lisa T. writes, this brief exchange is reminiscent of Outlander, when Claire first travels through time and all of the people that she meets wonder what a well-born English lady is doing in the Highlands. We are thus reminded that Claire is still an Outlander. She does not belong where she is. When the young redcoat says that he recognized Jamie from the broadsheets, this again emphasizes Jamie's vulnerability. Not only is he easily recognizable because of his height and red hair, but also he is a traitor to the crown and if captured would most certainly die a traitor's death. Jamie asks the boy for any reason why he shouldn't kill him on the spot. The boy says that he was prepared to die. He warms up his dirk blade, Jamie does, and allows it to touch the boy's clothing, burning it slightly. It's a warning, meant to scare him, but not harm. Jamie asks questions, and at first the boy refuses to answer. He places the blade against the underside of the boy's jaw. At this, Claire yells out. Jamie ignores her. He tells her it's no concern of his. Jamie then turns to threatening Claire. He forcibly kisses her, pulls her hair hard. The boy is finally affected by something. Jamie tears Claire's gown and shift, baring her breasts. She kicks him because she's, you know, freaking out. What are you doing, you man, you? And the boy is freaking out. Jamie proposes ravishing Claire in front of the boy and then giving her to his men and then the boy before he dies because, you know, you shouldn't need to die a virgin. Lisa T. writes, even though we know that Jamie is bluffing, what he is suggesting is by turns disturbing, erotic, and humorous. But we begin to see just how vulnerable Claire really is. Lisa I. writes, I didn't like that he uses her and was saying these things. Although I knew Jamie had a plan, not a very nice one, and I knew he wouldn't hurt Claire. So Claire is fighting back. She bites Jamie's hand, which is covering her mouth. He shoves a piece of cloth into her mouth to basically gag her. He opens her gown wider. Now this scene is priceless. Claire is pissed. Older men are looking away, and younger men are agog and aghast. The boy isn't happy. He says that because of the lady's honor, he'll have to oblige his captor. They get Claire covered, and Jamie resumes the interrogation. The boy answers the questions, and he gives all the information that he's asked. His name was William Gray, the second son of Viscount Melton. He accompanied a troop of 200 men traveling to Dunbar to join General Cope's army. His companions were about 3 miles west. He had gone out walking, seen the light of the fire, and came to investigate. Yes, he was alone. The troop carried heavy armament, 16 carriage-mounted cannon, and 2 16-inch mortars. Most troops had muskets, one company of 30 horses. He was questioned for almost an hour, Jamie asking the questions over and over to discover any discrepancies. Once he was satisfied that the information wasn't changing, then he ended it. Connie writes, Lord John Grey is a mushroom. In Diana's reckoning of characters as onions, mushrooms, and hard nuts, Lord John, I can only call him that, calls Jamie several names, which amuse the Scot. They are conscienceless outlaw, a rebel and an unprincipled voluptuary, unspeakable poltroon, and Scottish jackal. Now, regarding what Connie is saying about a mushroom, or onion, mushroom, and hard nut, this is a type of categorization of characters that Diana has made about different characters that kind of pop up. Well, a mushroom is one that pops up, but we can link to Diana's description of these different character types. Jamie made to act as if he were going to shoot him in the head or the heart. The boy chooses heart. He asks for assurance that Claire will be safe. Jamie admits that she's his wife. Claire's basically making a case for the boy at this point. Jamie decides to let the boy go if the information he took proves to be true. He says, "I give you your life. I hope you'll use it well." So before he left, he let Claire free to tend to the boy's injured arm. She walks over to Jamie and slaps him hard. Before he's taken away, young William says to Jamie, "I owe you my life. I should greatly prefer not to, but since you have forced the gift upon me, I must regard it as a debt of honor. I shall hope to discharge that debt in the future, and once it is discharged, I'll kill you." After they leave, the men laugh. Jamie orders Claire to return to the tent because he knows what is going to have to happen. And she doesn't. She doesn't understand why he would want her to. So she sees Jamie collect the men and find out who the sentinels were that evening. The two came forward, and Jamie doles out punishment. The men were being flogged. The group seemed to be relieved once this was over with. A certain normalcy, kinda, had been restored. This reminded me of Jamie beating Claire after she'd run away in Outlander. The men in the party treated her normally after she'd been punished, because all of the men had been in danger because of her actions. Like that, here, all of the men had been in danger, ultimately, because of the sentries. But Jamie blames himself too. It was his fire, indeed, that had first attracted the young boy. Jamie gives Murtaugh the strap to beat him, which he does. When Claire sees this is about to happen, she goes away, but not to the tent. She needs fresh air, and after it's done, Jamie comes to her. He apologizes to her for everything, for her gown and for all the rest. We learn that the boy had broken his own arm. He hadn't done it on purpose. And Jamie tells her, quote, "I could have broken him, Sassenach. Sometime I may have to," unquote.
I want to know what an unbreakable lock is. He's like, "I had him in an unbreakable lock."
Like a headlock kind of thing.
I know, but it was very self-assured that this was an unbreakable lock. Now, granted, the 16-year-old boy couldn't get out of it, but was it really unbreakable?
I don't know. I wasn't there.
You know what was breakable?
His arm.
His arm.
So he knows what he may have to do, and he is prepared to do it, if need be. Connie writes, "Insight born of seeing episode 115 and 116. Claire says that Lord John said Jamie couldn't do anything that would make him talk. Jamie's voice was weary. Quote, Christ, Sassenach, of course I could. You can break anyone if you're prepared to hurt them enough. I know that, if anyone does, unquote. This gives me cold shivers, Connie says, as I remember the Wentworth and To Ransom a Man's Soul episodes.
Yeah, so Jamie just became a total Debbie Downer right there. He's like, trust me, I know, you can break a man. And everyone
He's like,
went,
I know, I
and
was
everyone
there.
Everyone looked around awkwardly and went, uh-oh.
Claire finally says that given the choice between what he did and what he may have done, it was the lesser of two evils, basically. Claire then tends to his back. You know, the womanly sympathy he was looking for. Jamie admits that he wouldn't have shot the boy even if she hadn't come up with a reason not to. She finds food and feeds them both, and then he actually finishes ravishing her. Both Lisa I and Connie point out Claire's bringing up of Miguel de Cervantes, author of Don Quixote. Lisa I writes, "It is cute how Claire subtly refers to Jamie as quixotic. He can be brash and unpredictable, but chivalrous and romantic as well. I also like how Diana Gabaldon uses so many terms and vocabulary." Lisa T. writes, "This entire sequence is disturbing, erotic, and funny. The scene heightens the stakes. Jamie is in danger, not afraid to be ruthless. Claire is still an outlander and a woman in a place where she does not belong. The image of his warm arms sliding over her cold skin is beautiful and powerful. Jamie is warming and protecting her." And that was part of the "I will finish ravaging you" scene. Afterwards, Claire asks Jamie why he allowed himself to be beaten, and he says that Murtaugh enjoyed it. He's owed him a hiding since he was 9 and put honeycomb in his boots. Yeah, I agree, dude. You totally owed him that. He says that maybe it was owed to her as well, or to his men. So he did it to placate his own soul as well, his own heart, to bring himself to rights with his people. She feels very bad and blames herself. If only she hadn't come through the stones and told him what happened. So she, this whole chapter, she many times, right, is revisiting, oh my gosh, if only I could go back and I knew more. Well, but if I went back, should I even have come? It's always if. And then, of course, he later on is thinking about, you know, oh my gosh, is what she's telling me right? He believes her. He knows he's been at that stone, at the stones. He saw her as she almost disappeared. He knows that in his gut, but there's still that human, what if it doesn't happen that way? So this whole chapter, the next morning, Claire's awoken by a metallic noise. Jamie, his face covered in charcoal, freaks her out. He'd been out on a commando raid with his men to the English camp. They took the pins out from the cannon carriages, and they took the wheels from the carriages as well, and they're burning them. So regarding the pins pulled from the cannon carriages, Connie writes, maybe a necklace of cotter pins on a leather bootlace will be the next must-have Outlander fashion accessory. I can just see Etsy shops offering them soon. Jamie's also darkened his face with charcoal, having heard Claire tell him about commando raids.
Yeah.
That makes me laugh so much. Murtaugh's face is blackened too. And Connie says, I'm looking forward to seeing this in season 2. Oh my gosh, this is such comedy. If they don't keep it, it's a shame. Connie's provided us with some pictures of pins, of these cotter pins, which we can also share in our show notes. Claire is half naked in the tent in the morning, and he's telling her to get ready. They're about to move. Lisa T. writes, the fact that Claire being half naked and her shelter being removed from her reminded me of two different quotations from Outlander and earlier in DIA. Earlier in DIA, when Jamie finds Claire at Fontainebleau, she feels that the sight of Jamie might rip away the gray clouds that surrounded her. Quote, I would die, I thought, like a grub, naked and defenseless in the sun, unquote. Then the reverse parallel from Jamie in Outlander. Quote, it's like my own fortress has been blown up. There's nothing left of it but ashes and a smoking roof tree. And the little naked thing that lived there once is out in the open, squeaking and whimpering in fear. Unquote. With the Battle of Preston Pans and the arrival of the Redcoat, young William Gray, Claire and Jamie's world has completely changed and is beginning to shatter around them. Their shelter is gone and they are both vulnerable to the tremendous danger ahead. Another take on the scene with Claire, Jamie, and young William Gray is to compare this scene to Wentworth Prison in Outlander. At Wentworth Prison, BJR is holding Jamie and Claire prisoner. Jamie sacrifices himself for Claire and BJR breaks him. In this scene, Jamie is holding a young British soldier prisoner, and he also is restraining Claire. Young William sacrifices himself, or rather thinks he does, for Claire. As Jamie says, he could have broken William, but he chose not to. This is a twisted, comedic, but powerful variation on the theme in Wentworth Prison. That afternoon, they reached Tranent. Lisa T. writes, we will see not only Claire's and Jamie's perspectives of Preston Pans, but more generally, the feminine and masculine experience of battle. Jamie sends Murtaugh to look for Lord George Murray, the army's commander-in-chief. As she's getting herself cleaned up, the very man comes into the room. She's at the table with Jamie. Murray is frustrated that the prince's army is going all over the place. With the army split, then O'Sullivan, a confidant of the prince, ordered a contingent of Lochiel's Cameron clansmen to the Tranent churchyard. Cope brought up some of his men and bombarded them. Men were injured, other men getting kind of butthurt. Apparently, because O'Sullivan landed in Eriskay with the prince, he thinks he's all that. There are conversations as to whether they'll attack from the east or the west. So there's lots of drama with the prince, his higher-ups and battles, or even future potential battles in general. It seems like there's infighting. We learn that the English have turned about as well. So when the Scots have to dance, so do the English. Jimmy tells him about the men and bounty, including the 16-inch mortar. Murray takes him into the fold. So basically, Jamie has proven himself already by giving such intelligence to Lord George. Claire had met Murray in Paris before, and thought that his frustration with the prince and desire to not be around O'Sullivan was the reason he was pulling on Jamie rather than any special thing for Jamie. And the army was restless. So was Fergus. Claire writes a letter to Jenny Cameron, who'd led 300 clansmen to join the prince. When her brother had shown up to take charge, she declined to go home. She uses Jamie's bonnet as a signet, its clan crest on it, because she doesn't have any seal, any ring from him. She tells Fergus, quote, "For the Scottish milady with the freckles, she sends him away on an errand to keep him out of. She sends him away on the errand to keep him out of trouble." So this is part of Claire's plan. She gets Jenny involved since she thinks people wouldn't listen to her because she's English. And she learns from Jenny she's right, but they'll listen to this force of nature. They went around, she and Jenny, to collect blankets and other items to set up for their makeshift hospital or triage centers. Connie writes, "This short but very eloquently described encounter between Claire and Miss Jenny Cameron makes me want to know more about this Jenny. Well, I think we who want to know more are doomed to disappointment. There's no clear history or biography of her, according to this Wikipedia article, and we will also link to this in the show notes. The prince had returned with his army. Claire could see the lighting of the English fires. Fergus tells her dinner is ready, and she goes in. Fergus is so bored. He really wants to join the men. He really wants to be where the action is. Fergus wants to take a man to Jamie. He's found someone who has information for Lord George."
So you're saying he wants to be where the people are? He wants to see?
Wants to see him dancing?
We'll just call him Ariel.
Oh, gosh. "The name of this man is Richard Anderson of Wittburg. She thinks about changing history and wonders what might happen if she kept Mr. Anderson from talking to Lord George."
Mr. Anderson? That makes me think of The Matrix.
"Could she even have an effect on things? She couldn't risk it. She tells Fergus to go find Jamie." Connie writes, "According to Battle of Prestonpan 1745.org, a local farmer, Robert Anderson."
I think that's awesome that there's that's a website.
"A local farmer, Robert Anderson, knew of a path through the bogs passing close to the farm of Riggenhead. Just before 4 a.m., the long Jacobite column set off along the track, and by dawn, they were clear of the bog and assembled just to the east of Cope's troops." So this is truly part of history, and this man did have information that helped the Scots. The next day, the cannons start. Claire admits to herself that with her knowledge, she has some comfort. Her task is to make the women in the makeshift hospital busy and to be prepped to receive the wounded. The Scots were victorious, and the wounded began arriving. She tended them with her female voluntolds. I don't think they're really volunteers. She steps outside feeling dizzy and to get away from the warmth and fug of the bodies and the smokiness of the cottage. And she sees men returning to the village, Fergus astride a cannon. Now, Fergus can't hear anything. He keeps saying, "Madame, Madame." He thinks he's killed an English soldier, but he's not quite sure. And we're reminded that he is 10 years old. She takes him to a bed where other children are and leaves him there to rest. She hadn't yet seen or heard of Jamie and was a little worried, but there was so much to do in the hospital. And then he comes. The first time I, Ginger, got a tear prick in this chapter was when he comes in and his eyes find her, and Diana writes, quote, "Thank God," his dark blue eyes said, and "Thank God," my own echoed back, end quote. Claire had arranged that any Fraser men from Lallybroch were to be brought to the cottage where she was. We get a look at the conditions and the triage she was doing. It was far from ideal. Everyone was doing their best. But because she didn't trust the others to be as careful as her, she was going to make darn sure to have the Lallybroch men under her care. That one time when Jamie almost drinks from the urinal, she gives him a water bottle to fill, and along with emptying the bottle that's being used as a urinal.
Brr. So gross.
When he turns to go, she sees a horseshoe-looking mark on his back. Obviously, it looks like a horse stepped on him. But it wasn't on purpose, he says. It had happened when the Highlanders had dived under the English horses attacking them, afraid they'd attack with teeth and hooves. She asks him if he's urinated since then, and assures him it has to do with his health and asks him to fill up a urinoscopy cup. So he...
Does she have a urinoscopy cup?
Yeah. He asks her to go out and get one out of her bags or out of her boxes.
Like a specific urinoscopy cup.
She has one from Paris. And the funny thing is they start almost to make a game out of it. The men there, like, can you aim? Can you make it this far or do whatever? I don't think he actually did it. I think that comes later because I remember the conversation about him doing it and her being happy that he didn't that he didn't pee blood.
I think everyone's happy they don't pee blood.
Well, of course. What I'm saying is he never actually did it. They started to make a game out of it and he was going to do it. And then the prince arrives. And I wrote, reunited and it feels so good.
I don't think you wrote that.
I did not write the song.
Thank you. That's true.
I wrote that in the comments. Connie writes, Charles is immaculately dressed, including a cairngorm brooch. Now, a cairngorm is a smoky quartz. We'll also include a picture. Charles goes around the cottage, visiting the wounded, thanks them all for their deeds. And when he sees Jamie, he breaks into a grin. Mon cher! Why hadn't Jamie visited him? Jamie replies that his men are here. And Charles does not seem to like that answer. But... before he can actually say something, he expresses concern for Jamie's wound. He sees blood on him. And we find out it was a saber slash. Claire tells the prince it's not a serious wound. She sees, though, that the prince is definitely affected by Jamie's injury. Jamie is not just a Scot, a Highlander, whom this prince is going to thank for his deeds. Jamie is a personal friend. Now, Claire thinks that the wound had brought it home, that he was wounded on his order, on the prince's order, for his cause. He thanks Jamie, and in that moment, Claire thinks he may have made a good king.
I think that in that moment, I think this became real for him, because up until that moment, it was just this... We're gonna go back. I've got money now. So we're just going to go back and reclaim my throne. It's just going to be that easy. And I think that until somebody that he knew on a personal basis was injured on his behalf, I don't think it was anything more than that for him. I think in that moment it became a real thing where he was like, I'm going to kill people. Like this deed that I've asked them to do on my behalf, people are dying. I need to be better. I need to be more. I need to be worth it.
Lisa T. writes, cue the countdown to Culloden clock. The prince had a tent set up for the Jacobite dead. Claire counted the dead, which had gotten up to 26. Now, it's weird having that kind of knowledge. Could you imagine knowing things like this and then counting to see if the history books you were remembering were right? One man, Alexander Kincaid, who had a perforated intestine, was slowly dying. Claire found him with Jamie. Now, he was outside with Jamie. Jamie was holding him. They were sitting on a low wall, I think. And Jamie says, Claire checked and she knew he was dead. And Jamie says that he knew he was dead, but he didn't want to let him go. He didn't want him to die under a roof. They have a moment together, and Claire finally is able to shed some tears after the drama and tragedy of the day. Connie writes, the word picture Diana paints here of Jamie cradling Kincaid's body reminds me of the Pietà. And a Pietà in general is pretty much any image of the Virgin Mary cradling her dead son's body.
Now, if we look back at season one, Blackjack holding Jamie in that one scene was like
very,
a backwards.
Very Pietà.
Pietà.
Yeah. Well, no, it was a Pietà as far as the imagery.
No, I just mean it was flipped. If you looked at it, that's what I mean by backwards. It was just a flipped image. But it was.
Jamie being held instead of doing the holding.
No, I mean, Jamie was being held, but it was instead of left to right, it was right to left. Or if it was right to left, it was left to right. It was that.
I mean, like a
mirror image.
Okay. Claire says that she needs help with one dude, Hamish Macbeth. And I love Diana's name choice here. I don't know why. Jamie's thinking, Hamish Macbeth. Yeah, he's one of my favorites, right? He's thinking, this will be easy peasy. Hamish Macbeth is a massive yet quiet man. And he's got this beard that Claire describes, and a smile that, though rare, when he does smile, it appears like it brightens up his whole face and just kind of appears out of his beard. Now, this man had come into the casualty station, and Claire noted that he'd walked on his own with a, quote, ginger spraddled gait, unquote. I have to use that in life somehow. I don't know how I'm going to use it, but I like that line.
So anything you do could be a ginger spraddled gait.
Well, this is lowercase g, so all mine would automatically be uppercase g. But yeah, anything I do would be a ginger something. Now, Hamish told Claire that he would not let any woman lay hands on him to examine him. Jamie went with her to see what this all was about, while she waited in the background. Now, Jamie flipped back the kilt, and Claire could see the injury. The scrotum was torn, and his testicle hung halfway out. Jamie tells Hamish, it isn't bad. Because, you know, Claire's giving him kind of nods or shaking her head in the background.
Think they'll leave that in the show?
Oh, wait, like showing the testicle?
Yeah.
I don't know. That'd be awesome if they did, but I don't know.
I mean, they've shown some other stuff. Why not? We got to see
a boob.
A boob and a baby being born. And
a two-time Tobias.
Dinglehopper?
Yeah, Winkle. So Jamie gave Hamish a choice. He's like, look, this isn't bad. It can totally be fixed. Either I can stitch it up, and he made a point to show how ungraceful he was and how big his hands were, or his decidedly more graceful and talented, of course, wife could.
And dainty-handed.
And exactly.
And she was able to, like, immediately thread that needle.
Totally thread it, like a boss. And he consented to Claire with a sigh. But Jamie had to disinfect the open wound after she was done. Oh my gosh. Quote, a dreadful roar shook the walls and Macbeth writhed like a cut snake, unquote. He didn't move at all while she stitched him. Quote, only the changing colors of his face from green to white to red and back again betrayed his emotions, unquote. And then in the end, he turned purple. As he began to stiffen, he was still capable. As soon as she was done, he stood up and left. He was embarrassed.
Where were you going with that? That was a really long word.
So Lisa T. writes, this scene is symbolic because despite his wound, which could have unmanned him, but didn't, he was able to rise again. It is a metaphor.
The South will rise again.
Literally. It is a metaphor for the Highland Army. They are not defeated. They are able to rise again another day. It is called the Rising, after all.
Oh, Lord. Are we trying to say that this is just one big, like,
penis
metaphor? Like, this entire chapter, everything about Preston Pants. Is Preston Pants short for penis?
Preston
or long for
Preston
penis?
Penis.
Preston Penis.
Oh, should we call it that?
Maybe.
Oh, my gosh.
I like that one better.
I do, too. Oh, my gosh. Seriously?
But if it was a metaphor for girls, I would have had it be Preston Cans. If it was more about boobs.
Oh,
cans.
Got it.
Preston Cans.
Seriously, I'm tempted to call it that.
Preston Glands. That's what it needs to be.
Oh my gosh, that's better.
Preston
that
Glands.
Way we don't have to use the word penis in a title because I would forever be humidified. But I could do glands because that's... Actually, the penis is called the glands penis.
That's my point.
Claire is absolutely exhausted. Some of the wounded had wives who slept next to them, but not the men in her cottage. They had Claire. She was working her booty off and would do her best to manage them through the night. Connie writes, the caring, competent Claire we see here in this passage reminds me of the Claire we saw in the TV show when Geordie was gored by the boar, giving comfort and being practical and assured in the way she goes about her work.
I always chuckle when words rhyme. Sorry, it's inappropriate. You should see me trying to read Dr. Seuss.
As they sit together, Jamie and Claire, on a bench in front of the cottage, she asks him to tell her about the battle.
Tell me again how we all die.
Seriously. Tell me again how we all die, Preston Glands. Lisa T. writes, the strains of nursing and battle are beginning to take their toll on Claire and Jamie. He also begins to tell her his version of the battle, the masculine side.
There's nothing masculine about a testicle being ripped open and hanging out of a scrotum. Though there is nothing more masculine than a testicle in a scrotum, right?
They were ready for battle, Jamie says. There were no fires, so they wouldn't be seen. In the darkness, something grabbed his thigh, and he nearly bit his tongue off. It was wee Fergus. So Jamie went to see Anderson. That was, after all, why Fergus had been sent to find him, and the army moved off following Anderson's trail. So this dude really did help out. There next to his men, he'd slept before the battle. Diana tells us Jamie's trick of sleeping before the battle. You make yourself comfortable, examine your conscience, and you make a good act of contrition. You can't sin when you're asleep, so with nothing to look forward to the next day but victory or heaven, how can you be afraid? No, technically this wasn't Jamie's. Jamie did take this and make it his own, but he got it while he was a soldier
in France.
So in the field, present day, Jamie, this is at night before the next day of the battle, Jamie had thought of his men one by one. He thought of his wife, and even at this time before a battle, he thought of bedding her. He tried to reassure himself that it wouldn't be a slaughter. He knew what she had told him. He believed her. He's hoping and praying that she's right. He trusts her, but it's still the unknown. He remembers the look on her face as she is disappearing before the stone when he went to take her to go back. And he felt like he'd given her the choice to stay or go, and he had. But then as she'd walked into the stone cleft, he'd pulled her back. So even though he gave her a choice, he's still feeling guilty over pulling her back. He thought on each of his men as he continued, and then he began the act of contrition in French. Connie writes, and why do these words come most naturally to Jamie in French, I wonder? However, I will say that having attended Mass here in Costa Rica for 7.5 years, there are prayers that now come to me more naturally in Spanish than English. I think that makes sense. It depends on where you are at and the dominant language in the culture where you
used it most.
No, where you are living.
Well, I know, yeah. But I mean, I'm sure that they had the act of contrition in Scotland when he was growing up, the churchy stuff they did growing up. But I think that he probably got more use out of it while on the battlefield.
Oh, yeah. And when you learn something in a situation where there's drama and life and death stuff, it's like an imprint on your brain. And it sticks. Like, it just makes that much more of an impression on you. Before dawn, as the Highlanders were marching to battle, he'd come upon what appeared to be a sleeping redcoat, all alone. It was war, but he didn't want to kill a sleeping man, so he clocked him a good one with the butt of his musket. And then a man came upon him. It was the French priest, dressed in a shirt and a plaid. He tells him to lie down and not move till the shooting stops. The priest is thinking the redcoat's dead, so he wants to go over and like give him last rites, and Jamie's like, without wanting to, you know, bring attention to them and make a lot of noise, he takes the priest's hand and puts it to the redcoat's throat to show that, look, he's still alive, don't worry, don't waste your time with him, let's go. But there were sentries walking by about 6 feet away, and the soldiers, remember, it's coming up on the dawn, so it's still not bright yet. The soldiers convinced themselves that they were seeing things and that Jamie and the priest were safe. They ended up being safe. But then one of the men tripped over something, maybe the red coat, and Jamie had to get into action at this point. He smashed his blade on the man's skull and were off. The English now knew there were Highlanders aboot. Jamie's description of the growing battle, the cannons, the pipers, Diana does such an amazing job putting us into the field. And Claire, in her own way, knows exactly what he's talking about when he says he remembers everything and that it was yet like he was outside himself. Connie writes, it seems to me that this is the first time in the first two books, Outlander and Dragonfly and Amber, that we have had a shift of point of view. Am I wrong in that? Even if we get something...
When we had it in the beginning of this book with Roger.
Okay, outside of... But that Claire was not there. Oh, no, she was. Sorry. That's true. But you have scenes where Claire was not there at all. Everything else in the 18th century portion of Dragonfly and Ember, Claire's almost always there, right?
Yeah.
Like it was in
Outlander.
In Outlander,
she's the one telling the story.
Exactly. I still want to know who she's telling it to.
She's telling it to Roger. Probably Roger and Bree.
That's what I was thinking. I've never heard anyone talk about that. You know, I think I've mentioned it before, but she's telling somebody. In the morning came relief in the form of a surgeon and two women. Jamie and Claire grab something to eat, and he takes her a little ways outside the village where they can have some privacy and rest.
Did they rest?
And as they prepare for nap time, Jamie entertains Claire in his description of how he gets into his kilt. They lie down together. They make love and fall asleep. Connie writes, out of place with what we know now in the show, and Claire would have seen well before now about how a man gets into his kilt. But the TV show has been using the great kilt all along. Here, Claire says that Jamie usually wore the military, quote, little kilt. Laura Jane writes, I love to read about Lord William Grey, Claire and Jamie in the Preston Pans chapter. Fangirl squealing here, I had truly forgotten how masterful Diana's writing is in this segment of the book. Lisa T. writes, despite everything they have tried to do to change the future, Claire and Jamie begin the doomed, inevitable march toward Culloden. So for such a doozy of a chapter, it actually ended up not being a two-hour recording.
Oh, it felt like every inch of a two-hour recording.
It's only 10. I think we finished earlier tonight than we did last night.
We did, but...
but today's been a hooky of a day.
Dude.
No downtime, right?
Mm-mm. No.
That's chapter 36. And on the one hand, I am glad we're back in Scotland. Glad one battle's behind us. One long chapter is behind us. However, in my concern that, oh my gosh, this chapter is so long. I think it's probably the longest one. Let me check. Now, to be fair, I did not look at the book or even your spreadsheet to count page numbers.
Mm.
I just looked, because this is what I have on me. I looked at the Audible audiobook chapters and looked at the time length. Oh my goodness. Chapter 36, 1 hour, 19 minutes. Okay.
That's about what we
that's
just did.
About. Chapter 37, Summer, that's the next chapter. 1 hour and 30 minutes. Actually, 1 hour and 33 minutes. Hold on. 38 is 1 hour and 26 minutes. And then it's doesn't go over 1 hour-ish. Chapter 45, are you ready? 1 hour and 44 minutes. Chapter 46, Summer's shaking her head like, nope. I'm not going to be here for that chapter.
I'm going to take that chapter off.
Chapter 46, 1 hour and 41 minutes. And then everything else is under 1 hour. But we have just started the, we have just entered the territory of long-ass chapters.
It's the race to the end, people.
Oh my God. Dan is like, you thought you were almost done. I'm going to show you.
Well, it's like, it's so deceptive because you're like, oh, we're on
I'm
chapter 36.
The
there's
only
49
chapters.
Only 500
chapters. Pages left.
It's like, there's only 49 chapters. We're already in 36. We're almost done. But
Fooled you.
You win, Diana. You
so, oh, she
win.
Always wins, girl. So what did you think about this chapter besides now that you're happy it's over with? The cock hairs?
No. God, why?
It doesn't make me laugh. The Preston glands?
That was a thing of genius.
That was funny.
No, right now I'm just thinking about, I don't know that I'm ever going to not feel like I'm itchy ever again.
At least if we talk about lice for
good
half an hour.
Lord.
My head still itches, girl.
Stop saying it.
You brought it up.
I did.
So what was the highlight of the chapter for you?
I like that we met the little British
the little boy.
Little British hero.
I love the image, and I hope they keep it. Oh my gosh, talk about drama and comedy. I hope they keep the image of little Fergus riding up, straddling a cannon, not being able to hear a word Claire says. Madame? Madame? It's precious. It's precious. Oh my gosh, I cannot wait to see Fergus. I cannot wait to see our Fergus.
Oh, and he's the actor they have playing him is so
adorable.
Cute, too. So. Looking forward to
oh my
seeing
goodness.
Him in action.
All right, so join us next time when we discuss chapter 37 entitled Holyrood.
Holyrood.
And they're going to Edinburgh.
I imagine it's another fight.
Oh no, I think it's, oh no. Wait, but stuff goes down. It's a little more intrigue. Not so much battle. I mean, battles are happening, but that's going to be for the next episode. So thank you as always so much for listening. Don't scratch too hard.
Thank you to our generous audio host, audioboom.com. Our audioboom channel is www.audioboom.com/channel/outlanderpod. Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at OutlanderPod. Find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/OutlanderPod or email us at OutlanderPod at gmail.com.